Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer. So a week ago, I was on my way to Chicago for a joyous occasion. My daughter graduated from Northwestern University, and it occurred to me to reach out to a gentleman who had sent me a lovely condolence letter when my father passed. His name is Joe Caniff. And he's an instructor at the School of the Art Institute and DePaul University, and he also leads a lot of tours through Chicago and, more importantly, through the Art Institute. And he suggested that I take one of his tours, and I was bringing my stepmother, Roberta, who had never been to Chicago before, so I took him up on it. And it turned out to be one of the very best tours I've ever taken. It was a total delight. So I wanted to have Joe on the show. He very graciously agreed, and I have him on the line right now. Hey, Joe, what do you know?
How are you doing, Pauline? It's very delightful talking to you.
Well, it was a delightful, delightful tour. And I got to tell you, my stepmother, Roberta, absolutely fell in love with Chicago. And I think you were a big part of that. So let's talk first. We're going to get deep into the Art Institute and what you should look at when you go to museums, but I want to discuss Chicago a little bit first. What do you think people need to know about that great city so they can better enjoy it when they're there?
Well, I think that if I were coming to Chicago as a guest, there'd be certain things I would not miss. One of them is the Art Institute of Chicago, one of the world's greatest art museums. And in many ways, it reflects Chicago because Chicago is the city of many, many cultures. Secondly, I would be sure to take the architectural boat cruise. And if whether or not you have any interest in baseball, I think I'd see a baseball game, both the Chicago Cubs and the Chicago White Sox. Is real American culture, real Chicago culture. And just the excitement of being there and the scent of the popcorn and the hot dogs and the beer and the excitement of a ball game is something that I think everybody that comes to Chicago should experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the architecture front, You know, I have a bit of a chip on my shoulder because I'm from New York City. And so we think that we invented the skyscraper. Sure. But when you go to Chicago, you'll be told otherwise. And the great thing is, you know, we have rivers in New York City too, but they don't seem to go through the center of the city like they do in Chicago. And so you're on a boat and you're gazing up at these extraordinary temples of commerce and having a guide to tell you what they are, which is what happens on these architecture cruises. It's a wonderful experience.
It really, really is. And they are trained to do 100 buildings in 90 minutes.
Wow.
The name of the building and the name of the architect in a very quick description.
Yes. But they also bring it to life. Like there's one building that looks just like a corn cob.
Yes.
I think it's known as the corn cob building.
And right.
At the bottom of it is a parking garage
right.
with these cars that look like they're going to fall into the river at any minute.
Right. That's right. And they actually did in a Steve McQueen movie called, I believe it's called The Hunter from back in the 60s. That's Marina City by Chicago architect Bertrand Goldberg. And the idea was it would be a city within the city. If it's January and it's 10 below zero and you don't want to leave and go out, well, there's a grocery store in there. There's a bank. There's even a bowling alley.
Wow.
You can park your boat on the river. You can park your car right in there. And all the apartments are shaped like pies because, as you so aptly described it, the building looks like two pieces of corn on the cob. That's Marina City.
Yeah, interesting. And those were built for union members, right? By their union? Am I remembering that correctly?
I think there is some connection there, but I wouldn't want to steer you wrong on that.
Okay.
Up something interesting on that.
So what we did with Joe is we took his Art Institute of Chicago tour. And one of the big surprises was how much of, I don't know if it's right to call it a fluke, but how the Art Institute grew to be, because it did not start with a massive collection. It did not start with a big building, right? Tell us a little bit of the history of this great museum.
Well, the Art Institute actually began with a little art school and art museum across the street from the great buildings that we see today. But 1893 was the culmination of a new start for Chicago. We know that Chicago is a new city by world standards. Chicago didn't become a city till 1837. Then Chicago burned down in 1871, the Great Chicago Fire. But after that fire, ambitious people came here before the ashes were even cold. And some architects from Boston, Shepley, Rutan, and Coolidge, built the building that everybody knows as the Art Institute today with the lions in front. But that building was not built for the Art Institute. It was built for the great World's Fair we had here in 1893. Chicago wanted to show that we weren't just a cow town that burned down. We were a great city. And the visionary architect and city planner, Daniel Burnham, planned a great World's Fair in Chicago. It would be 400 years after the great voyage of Columbus. So they called this World's Fair the Columbian Exposition.
Huh.
And the Art Institute building was built for that World's Fair with the thinking that the fair would last just 6 months, and then that building could be turned over to the Art Institute of Chicago. But Chicago did not have such a great art collection back in 1893. We had a lot of copies of Greek and Roman busts and things like that. No one really wants to see copies today. People want to see originals. But as Chicago became more and more a prosperous city, collectors began to give us their wonderful collections. And today, the Art Institute of Chicago is one of the great art museums of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, was this the same fair that starred in that murder mystery book, A Devil in the White City, I think it was called?
It really is. And my favorite part of that book, it describes all the things that were new to Chicago and new to the world at that fair. Things like long distance telephone and an orchestra playing in New York that could be heard somewhere else, and a new caramel covered popcorn called Cracker Jack. And the beer that won the top beer award was ever since then was known as Pabst Blue Ribbon.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Clean washrooms, nurseries to take care of the children when their parents went to the fair. In Europe, people were saying, sell your house, sell your furniture, sell your clothes. You must come to Chicago. You must see this fair. All of these white buildings were built, temporary buildings with this classical look. There were canals with gondolas going down them in Burnham's vision, and people called it the White City. And the book that you're referring to, The Devil in the White City, is a murder mystery set in that fair.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so back to the Art Institute. When you go to it, it has the names of great artists etched around the front of it. But when it was built, the city didn't own any of those artists, right?
You're absolutely right. We did not. And we see very ambitious names up there like Raphael, Leonardo da Vinci. Well, that's well and good, but we don't have them. And I think you're going to mention this, Pauline. Somebody made a little mistake when they chiseled those names in there. somebody thought his first name was Michael and his last name was Angelo. And the way I always picture that is the boss says to the engraver, "You idiot, that's not how you spell his name." And the engraver says, "Now, just a minute. I happen to know Mike Angelo. He's got a garage on 37th Street, so don't tell me." You
know? Right, right. Yeah, it's funny. It's fun to go up and see that huge mistake on the front of the Art Institute. So when you go up the grand staircase, you get to what I think the Art Institute is best known for, which is its incredible collection of Impressionist artists.
Absolutely.
And the way you describe the Impressionists and how they came to be, and also how they came to be in Chicago, is in a certain way a life's lesson. You know, that's what I loved about your tour, that you didn't just say, "Oh, look at the brushstrokes and here's who they were copying or not." Mm-hmm. You really made this about the mostly men, but there was Bertha Morissette, is that her name?
Morissette. And an American in the group, Mary Cassatt,
yes. So mostly men, but those two women who were real rebels, right?
Absolutely. Because back at that time, let's say we were living in France in the 1870s, it was thought that for a painting to be considered a good painting, it should be about history, religion, or give us a lesson from mythology. A painting should lift us up in some way. It should make us better. If there's people in a painting, they should be people we look up to. King, queen, duke, duchess, bishop. Landscape painting, well, that was considered kind of the bottom of the barrel. But at least it should look like it took a long time to paint. Be smooth, polished, finished, and with no brush strokes visible. Then in the 1860s and 70s, these young artists came along that broke every single one of those rules. They went outside. They painted directly from nature, scenes of everyday life. And they didn't use the techniques of the old masters of working months on a single detail. They painted with short dabs of broken brush strokes. They were especially interested in light reflecting on things. So when they would submit the painting that we call Impressionism today to the judges, this is the way it worked. There was an official government-sanctioned art show there at that time called the Salon, S-A-L-O-N. And if you wanted to get your painting in the Salon, accepted by the Salon, you better follow the rules. So when the Impressionists would submit their paintings to the Salon, the judges would look at them and say, "Well, where's the history? Where's the religion? What are we supposed to learn from these paintings? Look at it's just people sitting around at a cafe. Look at this woman. She's got her back turned to us. Is that the right way to pose for a painting? And the whole thing is so messy. It's so blurry. They don't know how to paint." So the judges would take the paintings that we call Impressionism, turn them around and put an R on the back, which meant rejected. Then you'd really have a hard time selling your painting. You'd have to get the R off the back. What could they do? And you know what happened next up, Pauline. They had a wealthy friend who was also a wonderful artist himself, Gustav Caillebotte, Caillebotte. People always wonder about how do you say his name. Anyway, Caillebotte encouraged the Impressionists to forget about the Salon and to have their own show. When he met them, he became a friend of Renoir. Renoir introduced him to Monet, and Caillebotte was like, "Look, I'll finance a show for you guys. I'll find a place for you to exhibit. I'll do the publicity. I'll buy some of your paintings to get it off the ground. Let's give it a good try." So in the 1870s, there were these shows of these new artists. And there was a painting in one of those shows called Impression, Sunrise by Monet. And somebody looked at it and sarcastically sneered, "Well, is that what we're supposed to call this stuff? Impressionism or something? Is that the idea?" So the word Impressionism actually began as an insult.
Huh. Wow. So they did their own shows. They had their own kind of non-religious, everyday subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, so this was happening in France. In that way, they also were maybe taking a cue, and I'm curious to see if you'd agree with this, from the Dutch painters who, after the, you know, the Dutch broke away from the Roman Catholic Church, became Protestant, and mm-hmm. they too started painting things other than Mary and the saints and strictly religious paintings, right? At the time of Rembrandt, or was it before Rembrandt?
Rembrandt, you're absolutely right, Pauline. And it's a very good connection that you made. The Dutch were influencing the Impressionists in other ways too, with the shifting patterns of light that you'd see in their marinescapes. But basically it was like this. An artist has to eat and pay the rent, same as everybody else. It was the Catholic Church that could sponsor the artist, could buy their paintings back in Spain, in Italy, throughout the Catholic world. The Catholic Church is not going to want to pay you for a picture of people sitting in a cafe drinking wine or lawn bowling or something like that. So, but when Holland, as you mentioned, broke away and became an independent country, they did not have to rely on the church for patronage because they had developed a middle class that could buy their own paintings. How did Holland, what we Americans call Holland, they call the Netherlands, the lowlands.
Sure.
How did they achieve that financial independence? Because they were masters of the sea.
Yeah.
And they built these boats and became merchants to buy things in the East, like spices and silks, and sell them to the West. The Dutch have always been extraordinary businessmen. I had a Belgian man say to me once, "We have 100 beers in Belgium that are better than Heineken's, but the Dutch sell Heineken's all over the world because they're good businessmen."
Very true, yeah.
So if you go and see the Dutch masters, Rembrandt, Vermeer, they're not painting strictly religious subjects. Rembrandt did do biblical paintings as well, but that's not really what he's most famous for.
Right, right, yeah. And so, you know, what I loved about your tour and about today's discussion is paintings, there shouldn't just be art history, because art is part of world history. And because meat rotted, and in order to make meat stay good longer, you needed spices, which you could encrust it with, and that would help people keep their meat for longer and eat it for a long time. So that created a need for people to go to the places where these spices were grown. And so international commerce was created. And because of international commerce, you then had a middle class. And because of the middle class, you then had non-religious paintings. And it all is part of one messy ball of wax, basically.
Go ahead, please.
And so when somebody goes into a museum for the first time and they don't really know the history, say, of the artists, or if they're looking at contemporary art or modern art, what's your advice? How can they approach it and still get it without a great guide like you at their elbow?
Well, it's very flattering, Pauline, to call me a great guy. And I do, but I do try to keep learning every day. I try to learn something every time I walk through the doors of the Art Institute, even though I've been giving talks and tours there for more than 30 years. I listen to other guides and other speakers. And one woman said something once on a tour many years ago that really stuck with me. She said, "When you look at contemporary art, and you're kind of baffled by it, it's best not to think of it as art if that is your problem with it. Think of it as an idea." I call the contemporary wing the Museum of Contemporary Ideas.
Huh.
Because if you go in and look at an Ellsworth Kelly or a Jasper Johns, that people that just paint shapes and colors, people will say like, "Well, why is that art? I don't understand it." But I don't think that young art students today are mostly trying to paint like Rembrandt or paint like Monet, so much as they're trying to find their own distinctive, unique ideas. For example, my idea is to take a transistor radio that's playing rock and roll and attach it to a photograph of my great aunt, and the rest of it is painting in whatever kind of colors I want to use. That's my idea. Huh. I've combined the transistor radio and photography and painting. That's my idea. I also think that people that struggle with modern art, in addition to thinking of it as ideas, to keep the best definition of art that I know of in their minds. And the best definition of art is this. Some people say, well, art is involving skill. Art involves technique. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way to be art. For example, H.W. Janssen wrote in his great book, The History of Art, that Pablo Picasso once took the handlebars of a bicycle and the seat of a bicycle, put them together in such a way that it looks like the head of a bull. The seat of the bicycle is the head, and the handlebars are the horns of the bull. Now, did that take great technique? Did that take years of study? Did that take great skill? No. But what Janssen says, it's the leap of imagination, that makes that art. My favorite definition of art is this, Pauline. What is art? It is man added to nature.
Huh.
And if we think about it this for a minute, that doesn't mean, of course, that women don't do art. It's man.
Sure. Mankind.
Mankind, yeah. Right. Now, what do they mean by that? Well, according to such a broad definition, which I've been told is too broad by some people, but if you or I carved our initials in a tree, would that be art? Well, according to that definition, it would be, because the tree is nature and we are adding ourselves to it. However, I doubt there'd be many people that think my carving my initials in a tree is museum quality art.
Sure.
Or great art. Nevertheless, it's a broad enough definition to include all kinds of art.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's, I guess it's a topic that's bedeviled the philosophers, you know, what
yes,
is
it is. It has, and absolutely. It does, you're right.
Just as, what is life? What's the meaning of life? And you struggle with those questions when you go to a great art museum. On the tour we took with Joe, we saw these extraordinary stained glass by, oh my goodness, I'm blanking on his name.
Chagall?
The Chagall
windows? Yeah,
we saw
sure.
The incredible stained glass by Chagall. We mm-hmm. saw American Gothic, which a lot of people don't know is in Chicago. That is the famous painting of a man and his wife. He has a pitchfork. She looks dismayed. just the number of wonders at that museum are just yeah. astonishing. And I once read that the filmmaker Wes Anderson mm-hmm. Fell in love with the miniature rooms
oh,
in the
yes.
basement. Can you tell a little bit about the miniature rooms?
Oh, yes. There was a lady, actually her maiden name was Narcisa Niblack. She was a lady from Indiana. And as I understand it, her uncle was in the Navy. And he used to send her these little mementos and knickknacks from his journeys, and she'd put them in her dollhouse. She became very interested in miniature things, and she married into a wealthy family. She became known as Mrs. James Ward Thorne. And what she did was commission experts to help her make these miniature rooms in which 1 foot becomes 1 inch. And these rooms are so painstakingly accurate. But let's say you were the art director for a movie. People say, what's an art director? Well, an art director is the person in charge of the way the movie looks. So if you were an art director for a movie and you said, you know, I'm planning a scene that's supposed to look like a Virginia living room in 1740. What should it look like? You could just go to the Thorne rooms in Chicago. That's yeah. how accurate they are. The pictures on the wall, the furniture, the lighting, the tiny little things on the table. Well, I'm art director of a movie, and I'm wanting to do a scene that looks like a Paris library in the 1930s. What should it look like? Go to the Thorn Rooms again in Chicago.
Yeah, they're magical. They really are. Well, it's been such a delight talking with you, Joe. Well, I thank you so much. And if people want to take your tours, we don't usually give out email addresses, but I'm going to do it today.
If you'd like to try to get a hold of me and ask about an Art Institute tour, you're welcome to. It's just J Kniff, CUNN, like New York, IFF, like Frommer, .dePaul, DEPAUL, .edu, as in education. And I think you could talk to anybody about anything, Pauline.
Oh, well, you're very
easy to talk.
Thank you so much, Joe. Really appreciate having you on. Safety is front of mind for many travelers nowadays because we have seen a rash of crashes and near misses, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. To help me talk about some of the issues involved with that, I have Jeff Gazzetti on the line. He is an aviation safety consultant. He is a former NTSB investigator, so he knows his stuff. Hey, Jeff. Thank you so much for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show.
It's good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you here. You know, for my entire career, which is now years long, I have been saying that flying is the safest form of travel. You don't have to worry if you're getting in an airplane. It's much safer than driving. And I would assume that's still the case. But let's start this interview on a positive note. Do the stats still show that flying is the safest way to travel?
Absolutely. They still show that. Even with this recent spate of fatal commercial airline accidents, commercial airline travel is the safest form of transportation in the world. Better than taking the train. It's certainly better than driving your car in terms of accident rates. And yes, there's so much redundancy in the industry that even a spike, a short-term spike that what we've seen really has very little effect on the odds of the remote odds of being hurt in an airline accident.
Okay, so the odds are good, but I know a lot of people have a lot of traditions when they get on an airplane. I know some people, tap the outside of it. I have a little ritual I do. When I sit in my seat, I count the number of seats between me and the emergency exit. Now, I think that's actually a logical ritual. Would you agree?
That's absolutely logical. In fact, if there was anything on my list, that would be number one for surviving. You know, if you're concerned about surviving an accident, you want to improve your odds. Just be aware of exactly where you're sitting with respect to the emergency exit. And right. You don't have to be at the emergency exit. You could be several rows away, but you just need to know where the closest emergency exit is and kind of think about how you would get there if you needed to.
Now, does booking seat 11A help you? As many people know from that recent horrific crash of Air India, the miraculous survivor was in that seat. And so I've heard there's been a spike in people trying to get 11A. Is that a lucky seat?
No, I don't think it's a lucky seat. I mean, it certainly was lucky for this one survivor.
Yeah.
But Pauline, I mean, he was close to an emergency exit, but the crash dynamics of that Air India flight and the huge fireball, you just can't predict where the aircraft is going to be damaged, where the fireball is going to occur. There are just so many factors involved in surviving a serious airline accident. There's cabin structural integrity, seat belts, seat design, brace positions, fire retardancy, the design of the exit, the location of where the impact damage is occurring. So there's just so many factors that just saying, oh, 11A is the safest seat is not a logical assumption to make.
Right. And you said that 11A wasn't even one of the emergency exit seats. It was near them, but it wasn't. And so the people who were sitting in the emergency exit row, which you would think is safest, they didn't make it out.
That's right. That's correct. That's right. All those passengers that were seated in an emergency exit row died. And yeah. This gentleman who was close to an emergency exit, he survived. And ironically, his brother, who was seated on the exact opposite side of the airplane, same row, I think it was 11F or 11 whatever, he perished. So, yeah. And that's likely as a result of, again, the unique impact forces that occurred as this particular airplane impacted a particular building in a particular attitude with a particular ignition of the fuel in the wings. So you just can't predict these things.
So we know that 11A isn't a lucky seat. Do we know whether or not we can lay the blame here? Obviously, they're still doing a lot of investigations, but should people be avoiding Air India? Should people be avoiding this type of plane? I mean, is there anything? I think that when people trust themselves to a tin can that's hurtling through the sky, they want to do everything they can in their power to be in control or at least feel in control. Is there anything you should do research-wise before booking a flight towards safety? Maybe not just in the U.S. I know in certain countries there are different safety standards, right?
There are, absolutely. And you should do your research. First of all, with regard to the actual type of airplane that crashed, the 787, it's got a stellar safety record. So I would not be concerned about that particular airplane. Now, then you mentioned Air India. So I would think that Air India and their aviation system is very safe, but probably not as robust as U.S. airlines here in the United States. And not as robust as the U.S. oversight of the Federal Aviation Administration. So Air India probably is a little notch below the U.S., but it's certainly not to the point where I would be concerned about that. And I can't say that about other countries. There are several other countries that have less safe reliability. And the FAA website actually lists these countries that don't meet FAA standards. In other words, the FAA will not allow those countries to have airliners fly into the United States because they don't feel that they meet the standards. Right. And so though you should definitely do your research on foreign air carriers and who oversees those carriers and what types of accidents they occur. But I think the U.S. and India, as well as most European countries, they operate at a safety level that's on par with the United States, which is the best in the world, I think.
Right, right. Well, good to hear. That's good to hear. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have?
Well, so I just want to mention with regards to the chances, with regards to improving your chances to survive some sort of unfortunate event in an airliner.
Yeah.
Passenger education plays a crucial role. The FAA requires that passengers receive a pre-flight briefing. It's that briefing you always get from the flight attendants.
Yeah.
And they ask you to review the safety card, right? But they did a survey and they said about 2/3 of passengers in the U.S. don't even look at the safety card. And then there's a lesser percentage that don't even listen to the safety briefing. I would encourage your listeners to always listen to the briefing, even though they've heard it over and over again, and to take a quick look at the briefing card. And finally, just like what you said, what you do, have situational awareness of exactly where you're seated in the airplane and where the nearest emergency exit is. I think if you do that, and also wear clothing, that's the other thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
Wear long pants, don't wear flip-flops, wear real shoes. Just be prepared that if, again, something bad happens, you don't have to walk over jagged metal with your flip-flops and your short pants. So don't take your shoes off before takeoff and just be prepared in that, right? I think if you do that, that's about the maximum you're going to be able to do to increase your chances of a very, very remotely possible accident.
Right. Towards that end, maybe don't knock back two martinis in the airport before you take off. You know, you want to be prepared for anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay.
I hope you've set a lot of our listeners' minds at ease. Thank you so much, Jeff, for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show.
It was my pleasure. I'm a huge fan of Frommer, and I have many of your books.
Oh, thank you. And that's it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And let me ask a favor. If you enjoy this show, if you listen to us on Spotify, if you listen to us on Apple Podcast, please don't be shy about giving us a 5-star review. That would really, really help our reach. Thank you so much once again for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Watching cable, well, it feels so far away. All the channels seem the same. Trying to remember all the songs we like to play, 'cause those lazy afternoons don't come so frequently these days. Oh, it's been so long, and I cannot help but wonder,
luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.